Members, the House Committee on Elections will come to order. We do not yet have a quorum. When we do, we'll do the housekeeping things that we need to do. But for now, members, we have two bills before us today that were before us at a prior hearing, and they were laid over. So there's no parliamentary maneuver that requires just taking them up for discussion again. So we'll just take them up for discussion again. Out of respect for Representative Erickson and his time, because this is now the second hearing for which he's appeared on this bill, Representative Erickson, if you would, please, why don't you come on up and we'll resume discussion of your bill, which is House File 224. And members, just for your recollection, as I'm sure you know, but for the benefit of the public, this was the bill that would change the current cap from 400 to 1,000 for municipalities or for townships or cities that can qualify for doing mail-only balloting. Right now, as we heard in the prior testimony, about 46,000 people in Minnesota live in municipalities that do qualify and that do, not that do qualify, that do use, do actually use that. So about 46,000 Minnesotans live in places that have only mail balloting. There's some information to that effect that is being passed out right now, I believe, to members, or shortly will be. And this is information about which townships by counties. You'll see this alphabetically. This information came from the Secretary of State's office. This is by counties, starting with Aitkin County and going alphabetically. Those townships within, I think it includes cities as well, but I think it's those jurisdictions by county alphabetically that currently use this system, and then it gives the voter count. And remember, members, as we discussed before, this is pegged to number of voters, not population. So it's 400 or fewer voters, not 400 and fewer people. So it includes the voter count. And then, interestingly, and this is something I confess I didn't know, there's a differentiation in many cases between whether they use this procedure for state and county races and whether they use it for municipal races. And as you can see, members, on the cover, for example, in the communities in Aitkin County, I think everyone in Aitkin County differentiates. So they do use mail only for state and county races, but they prefer to use the old-fashioned way for their own municipal township races. So this is just for your instruction or for your edification, members. When we last left off, we laid this over for a couple of reasons. I think that members wanted justifiably some more information about the ranges of cities and townships that would fall within both the current law and the proposed changes. And you'll see also, either in your packets or being handed out right now, there's a single page that was helpfully provided by the League of Cities that gives some of the information that members were seeking the other day when we heard this, namely the spreads and how many cities fall within certain population spreads, because Representative Dowd, Sanders, O'Driscoll, and others had asked how many more municipalities, both townships and cities, we would be sort of bringing into this system. So hopefully this will answer some of those questions. The other thing, as I understand, Representative Erickson, tell me if this was your recollection too, but on House File 224, it seems like we're in substantial agreement, everyone is, more or less, about line 1.13, namely that the individual precinct increase from 50 to 100 seems not to have drawn many or any objections. But was that your understanding, that portion we seem to be in agreement on, at least in this committee?
Yeah, that would be my recollection also, Mr. Chairman. I don't imagine that would be involved many. I would just like to point out, though, that in my district, there are 31 township or areas in Beltrami County that take advantage of this. There are 6 in Hubbard, 5 in Clearwater, and 75% of Lake of the Woods County is using mail-in ballots at this time. So,
right,
it's a huge issue for me.
No, I understand, and I think in a lot of areas in our state, it's a big issue. If you remember before, members, and because we laid this over and don't have another engrossment, what you have in front of you in your packets won't reflect the fact that we adopted an amendment last time as to some wording. We talked about the word town instead of the word township. And my understanding, let's That's right. And there was also an amendment, and I can't remember, did we adopt that amendment? No, we didn't. But there was an amendment or a proposed amendment that would have made a grammatical correction here. And Mr. Gehring, do we have that amendment?
We don't have
Okay. Maybe, Mr. Gehring, could you just clarify what was intended there? And this is just, as I understand it, technical and grammatical.
Mr. Chair, the proposed amendment was just to clarify that the exception that mail balloting is only permitted in towns and cities located outside of a metropolitan county. And so the clarification would be page 1, line 7, strike and insert comma if the town or city is. And then on page 1, line 8, after 473.121, insert a comma. And that's just to reflect that the grammar of the sentence has changed, so that you're covering both towns and cities outside of a metropolitan county.
So, Mr. Gehring, as I understand it, on line 1.7, rather, you would strike the word and add the words, if the town or city is.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Does anyone on the committee have a question about that oral amendment? I'll just offer it as an oral amendment. It was suggested by Mr. Gehring as a way to get this in order grammatically. Okay. Seeing no questions or comments, all in favor of the oral amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. So now what we have is the bill is amended both by the one that we just passed, and, of course, there was the minor one from the other day where we changed township to town. As I mentioned, my understanding is that we're all in accord as to line 1.13. There is a recognition that the precinct-only designation should be substantially increased, but we're not yet in agreement on line 1.7. And I know that some of the information that members might have now will better inform all of us in terms of how we might make that change. I did find out in response to, I think it was Representative O'Driscoll's question the other day, I believe it was Representative O'Driscoll who asked, when was the last time that this 400 number in line 1.7 was changed? Because that would inform his view, I think he said, of how high or to what extent we ought to change that. And the answer is 1987. So it's been 400, we believe, since 1987. And I understand Mr. Gelbman's telling me that's the first year that mail-in ballots were allowed. So since the inception of this statute, which was 1987, the number has been at 400. So if that informs members as to how high we ought to go, then I think that would be a good thing. Do you have any comment on that, Representative Erickson, in terms of, you don't have to sort of show your hand here, but if there's some number other than 1,000, given that this hasn't been raised since 1987, do you care to express a preference or not? Or?
I would not. I would like to ask if Kent is in here, if he would care to comment on that.
Sure.
Or some of the other presenters from last week.
Mr. Sulem, do you care to comment about that? You need not. You can say no.
I don't know that I have anything to offer.
Okay. I just wanted to give you the opportunity. I know that there's at least one other testifier who's contacted us in advance and wants to be heard on this bill. Mr. McGrath, are you ready to? Did you want to speak to this bill?
I have kind of general testimony on both bills.
Okay.
As far as the number,
okay. Well, I'm just as to this bill, though. Generally, this bill, and we'll call you up for the other bill as well. Do you want to speak to this bill other than the number?
Like I said, it's kind of a combination.
Okay. I'll take that as a no. Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a general comment. I think that it's my understanding that the townships are in favor of this bill, and the cities really aren't taking a position on it. Is that the case? I don't know if there's somebody here from the League.
Representative Dowd, if there's someone here from the League who could maybe clarify their stance, I think that would be helpful to all of us. You just introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Ann Linser with the League of Minnesota Cities. Representative Simon, Representative Dowd, we don't have an official position on it, but this very much is in accordance with our positions of local control, and this would give cities more options for conducting their elections as efficiently as possible in accordance with the counties.
Representative Dowd.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess as I look at this, and I don't necessarily have a problem with it if it's something that people are asking for, but I what I haven't heard too much of is hey, we really need this. And, you know, I know...
From the cities.
Right, right. And I think, you know, the townships, and even the testimony from Representative Erickson, the first day that we heard this bill, you know, we talked about some townships where it really is a problem to get to the polling place. You know, I think in those areas, we're already handling it under the current statute. They're already allowed, and they, you know, even your area, you said they were already doing mail-in voting. So maybe on this particular issue, if it's the townships that really are asking for this, maybe we don't bump the city number at all. I don't know. The other concern that I had, and maybe this second handout, I'm just kind of reading it as I'm sitting here, maybe this gives me more information. This handout from the other day about the population of the cities is different because the bill actually, the language talks about number of registered voters, if I remember right, before June 1st, or on June 1st, the number of registered voters. Is that correct? Yeah. So really it isn't the population of the city that's relevant, it's the number of voters that are registered in that city or in the township. So I'm not sure if this even tells us. I would expect it's probably a lower number of cities that are affected by this than the population numbers indicate. But I don't know. I guess just I'm kind of thinking out loud as I'm talking here. But I guess I'm looking for really compelling reasons to change this stuff. So and I don't know that I've heard that yet. And particularly from the city side of it, I know that it increases flexibility for both. You know, I was a township officer. I can remember, you know, those meetings and running the elections. And I actually served as head election judge in my township, and as an election judge numerous times in my township. So, as we know, in Minnesota, townships are 6 miles by 6 miles. So, townships that have a population higher than this threshold already shouldn't be townships where people are driving 50 miles. And I wonder if the current statute hasn't already dealt with this, where there would be real problems. And I guess my question is, I haven't heard testimony, or my comment is, I haven't heard testimony from people where there's real problems right now coming in saying, hey, we need this changed. It sounds like it's just maybe about flexibility. So, and I'm not even saying I'm against it. I don't know. This is one that I hadn't really thought too much about. But I want to make sure when we're making these changes that we're doing the right thing. So no question, just a comment.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if maybe we could ask Ms. Frazier to come up. I just have a question I'd like to ask her.
Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair and members, Beth Frazier from the Office of the Secretary of State.
Ms. Frazier, I don't know if you're going to have the answer to this question because literally just as I had stepped out to visit with Representative Sanders and came back in, it dawned on me. What percentage of a population in a community, if you were to take a city of 10,000, or do we have statistics in the state of Minnesota, are registered voters in a city? In other words, if we were to take a city of 10,000 people, could we say that two-thirds of those people are eligible voters, the other two-thirds or the other one-third would be under the age of majority to be able to vote? Do we have any statistics statewide on that or any kind of a barometer? I'm not saying on a city-by-city basis, but do we have any kind of an idea globally what our percentage of registered population versus ineligible?
Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, I believe that in Minnesota we have about 5 million residents and about 3.8 million eligible voters. So
on a pro rata basis,
four, approximately on average,
about 60%, Mr. Chair. I mean, I'm just and again, just for discussion, and I will get to the reason why I asked that question. Based on the information that the league provided us, that cities of 2,500 or less in population are 635. Of the 853 that we have, that moves that number of people when we talk about registered voters to 74.5% of the cities in the state of Minnesota. Where the other day, the group, I think the committee took a a gasp when they heard 60% of the cities that could be affected. That number has, in fact, just gone up on that. And so I think we need to, as you pointed out, and as Representative Dowd pointed out, need to keep in mind, not population registered voters. And so 60% of 2,500, and I haven't done the math on that, but that gets us pretty darn close to that number of individuals here.
Yeah, I think the figure is, Mr. Burden said, is about 76%. In other words, the 3.8 out of 5.1 million. It's about 76%.
Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, I would point out that this relates to cities outside of the metropolitan area. So we're actually looking at the 504 cities with populations under 1,000, I think.
Mr. Chair, that is a good point, but we don't have, nor did we request or expect to have at this point, of those 504 non-metro, how many would have 2,500 or less population? Nonetheless, we're in a discussion work session on this. I think that that's an important part as we're trying to define the scope of how this would work. Second thing that occurs to me that I'm sure many have also seen in the popular media is that the U.S. Postal Service is looking to reduce postal service. Does that potentially disenfranchise individuals because of the movement of mail? Not saying it does, just simply asking the question.
Mr. Chair.
Interesting.
And members, Fraser. You know, the two county auditors who were here the other day, the two county election officials from Crow Wing County and Blue Earth County, are not able to be here today. But Ms. O'Connor from Blue Earth County in particular is interested in seeing the cap raised, and that there are jurisdictions in her county in particular where the jurisdiction falls above the 400 registered voters, but that she thinks it would be more beneficial for the voters and more cost effective to use mail balloting. And I know that whenever we get around to the cutoff, there are always cities and towns that are hoping they'll be, you know, have 399 this year and not 402, so that they're still eligible to use this type of voting that they have used.
President O'Driscoll, any further comments? Okay. Ms. Fraser, anything else?
No, Mr.
Okay. Is there any other comments on this bill from committee members or the public? Okay. Well, it sounds to me like we have not yet arrived at a number that will be satisfactory yet. I think that number is something we can agree on, probably not today and probably not at this committee. Representative Erickson, I want to be respectful of your time, and rather than drag out what is, a back and forth on what the right number is, I think the best thing to do is to lay this over again, which is not uncommon in this committee, and at some point we'll maybe ask you to come back, but thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My time is your time.
Members, why don't we take up then House File 193, which we also laid over for possible future consideration, and this is the No Excuses Absentee. Representative Halverson, we do have a quorum now, so I don't know if you have a chance to review the minutes of February. What would it have been?
Fifth. Mr. Chair, I have reviewed the minutes, and I would move approval of the minutes.
Okay. Representative Halverson moves approval of the February 5th minutes. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion is adopted. Because it's my bill, even though we have some housekeeping matters to take up, I'm wondering, Representative Halverson, if you could take the chair. Thank you.
Representative Simon, we are taking up House File 193, and I understand that there is a DE amendment that you'd like to offer.
Yes, Madam Chair, if I might move that. I'll move the DE1 amendment. And I'll just remind members, this reflects what we've already done as a committee. Because we laid the bill over and didn't take further official action on it, there's no cause for or excuse for Representative Gehring or anyone else doing another engrossment. So this is kind of a way around that. We'll do the DE1. That way everyone's looking with fresh eyes at exactly what we've already done. So there's nothing in here that we haven't already discussed and agreed to. So I'd move the DE1 amendment.
Very good. Representative Simon moves the DE1 amendment. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought it would be useful to revisit this once again, and I'm not sure that we'll be able to come to a conclusion today on this. There's some important details that we need to discuss further, both here in the committee and then offline. I know we have some testimony from Mr. McGrath and perhaps others. It seems to me, and I don't want to speak for those who have raised these points, but I want to make sure I'm clarifying what the points are that still need to be resolved. One is this business of what information people on the absentee voter application have to provide. And if you recall, under current law, and we didn't put this in your packets for this time, but just remember from last time, since 2008, since the bipartisan working group got the bill passed after the 2008 recount, well, before the 2008 recount, all that was required was the signature, is my understanding. And Ms. Fraser, holler at me if I'm getting the technical details wrong. So before then, it was just the signature, and that put election judges in a difficult position. It made for some recount headaches where people were scrutinizing whether a signature was or was not the signature of the person who filled out the application. And so with the help of many members, some here in this room, prominent among them Representative Winkler, we got to a bipartisan compromise, which Governor Pawlenty signed into law, which was the form that is now for your review at the Secretary of State's office upstairs, which basically says that for the applicant for the ballot, you have to either provide a driver's license number, the last four digits of your Social Security, or attest to the fact that you don't have those things. And what we emphasized last time, what Representative Winkler and others who were involved with that emphasized, is this particular piece has nothing to do with voter verification of the kind that we usually think of. Are you who you say you are? I mean, it is in a sense, but it could be any number. It could be your locker combination. It could be your phone number. It could be the number you use when you're buying lottery tickets. It could be anything. The point is a number that you can remember that you put on the application that you use with your actual ballot when you send it in, so that the election judge can match it up in a way that doesn't force them to become handwriting experts. So I know there was some, and probably still is, some desire to make that some sort of government number. But that seems to, at least in my mind, miss the point. The point was just to pick a number, any number that can match the person, regardless of other factors. So, I guess, Madam Chair, it's at your discretion. That's one point of discussion here today on the bill about whether, perhaps not today, but generally speaking, we can speak to what needs to be on the form, keeping in mind that under current law, it says driver's license, last four of social, or check the box that there's nothing. There was an amendment, I think there still is in the packet, that would get rid of the nothing line and replace it with some other form of government ID. And so in the spirit of that amendment, which is in the packets, but I don't know that anyone's going to formally move that, they're certainly welcome to, but that's the sort of idea. And so at your discretion, Madam Chair, we might want to have a discussion about that issue, about what goes in the application.
Very good. And to clarify, and perhaps Ms. Fraser can clarify this, making sure that we're understanding that we're talking about two different uses for the number, that this is separate from making any kind of identifying voter eligibility identifying numbers. Could you speak to that just briefly so that we're clear on what numbers we're talking about when?
Yes. Madam Chair and members. There's a difference between when you provide numbers on your voter registration application and when you provide them on an absentee ballot application. And when you provide them for the purposes of voter registration, your driver's license number, state ID number, the last 4 digits of your Social Security number, which are required by federal and now also by state law, are verified with either the driver's license database or the Social Security database. Or under federal and state law, if you don't have any of those numbers, you attest to that. The absentee ballot application is different in that is not required by federal law to provide any numbers, and as Representative Simon said, prior to 2010, domestic voters did not provide any ID numbers, and those numbers are simply used for verifying that the ballot was returned by the same person who applied for it. They are not verified against any other database.
Thank you very much. Representative Lane.
So, in fact, we're just asking somebody to provide a password. And it could just be a password that you remember from one part of the absentee ballot to the next step, right? By putting this other one on there, we confuse people and make them think it's going to be verified in some way. It's an eligibility thing. But I suppose the reason we didn't say password is because nobody remembers their passwords. Trying to find something that people have handy. Is this have anything to do with it?
Ms. Fraser.
Madam Chair, Representative Lane, it basically is a password. That's right. We used the model used on the voter registration application and the model that had been used for military and overseas voters since 08, where they provide ID numbers that are verified. But it basically is a password.
Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, I guess I have a question for Ms. Fraser, who's sitting right next to me. So if someone put as their driver's license number on there something that wasn't actually their driver's license number, they didn't have their driver's license with them, but they said, well, I got to put a number. I'm going to put 12345678 as my driver's license. Mm-hmm. And then on their actual absentee ballot that they send back, they put the same number. Is anyone at the Secretary of State's office or at the county level or anywhere else verifying that that is their driver's license number? Or are they just looking to see whether the number they put here matches the number they put there?
Ms. Frazier.
Madam Chair and Representative Simon, I believe that they're just comparing the number provided by the voter on the absentee ballot application to the voter, to the number provided on the return envelope.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Representative Simon.
Well, that's kind of what I thought, which is why, I hope, and we're probably not going to resolve this today, but I hope that that can allay some of the concerns of folks who might be suggesting a government number. I think the point is no one's verifying, and we can have a whole discussion about whether they should or not, but for two elections now, mm-hmm. statewide elections in 2010 and 2012, the point is to put a number that's the same on your application as on your ballot, and it could be anything. Those two numbers were chosen, and maybe Representative Winkler could weigh in here about kind of the origins of all this, but the point is there's no one that's going to verify that this really is a duly issued number for you. Passport number, military ID. The point is some sequence of numbers, some objective indication on one end to match up with an objective indication on the other. I suppose there's nothing to say it has to be a number. You could say your mother's maiden name or, you know, your childhood dog's name or anything else you use on any other, you know, commercial website. I think the point is to match up something objective on one end and something objective on the other end. I'd be interested, because I know Representative Winkler worked on this, to see whether that was the general idea. But
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the Chair called on me to address this question. And I think the Secretary of State's office can address the thinking behind it. But this was a carefully negotiated and long discussed issue with Representative Kiffmeyer at the time to try to move this forward. And Representative Kiffmeyer, I think, began the discussion much where I think Representative O'Driscoll's amendment is, which is that they wanted to have only numbers and they had to be state issued numbers and there would be no opportunity for somebody to leave it blank if they didn't have something to fill in. But in the context of trying to increase ballot integrity, absentee ballot integrity, she, and I can't speak for her, but the discussion was that it was better to have objective numbers than signatures. And so this was considered to be a step forward in ballot integrity, I think, by everybody and all concerned. And so the situation that we have now is better than it was before. It was not intended to be a way of verifying voter identity. Nobody's checking that against a database. So it was a step forward in ballot integrity. It was a compromise, and it worked. And absent evidence that that's not working today, I think that compromise still holds.
I have a question for Ms. Frazier in terms of you mentioned that we've gone through two elections now with this process. Have election officials seen improvements in the process from before trying to match signatures?
Madam Chair and members, yes. The election officials have found it much easier to come to consensus about whether numbers match as opposed to whether signatures match. Looking at an objective standard is a lot easier. And what we found is that in the past two elections, the acceptance rate for absentee ballots has gone up and up, and that the reforms that we've put in place seem to be working for voters. In the 2012 election, over 99% of voters who returned a ballot by election day had it accepted and counted. So the reforms are working.
Thank you, Ms. Frazier. Is there other discussion to this particular point? Representative Simon, anything additional on this point?
Well, again, I think this is something that members might just want to think and between now and when we next take this bill up about what they think about all this. But I certainly understand the impulse to have something, some other kind of number there. But perhaps offline we can have a discussion about what form that would take and whether we can reach some sort of accommodation about that. The other issue, and I don't know if there's any other discussion on that issue, Madam Chair, but the other issue that I wanted to remind members of that came up with respect to this bill, the other major issue, has to do with those on permanent absentee ballot status. We have such a thing already in current law. This bill would, at least as introduced, say that from now on, the folks who are on that status, that permanent absentee status, would get not every 2 years, they would not get merely the automatically sent to them an application, they would get the actual ballot sent to them. And I know there were some folks who had some concerns about that. And so this might be a good time to revisit that issue, if members care to discuss it.
Very good. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I have a lot of concern about just mailing out a ballot. Got a background in law enforcement. I've seen a lot of fraud and counterfeiting. I think if we automatically just send out a ballot instead of application, we reduce voter integrity and the ballot integrity. If we automatically send out the application and the application is returned, we don't have a ballot floating out there.
Representative Simon or Ms. Frazier? Any question, comment to that? I would have a question in terms of since we're doing this partially right now, it's going out to people who have disabilities who can apply for permanent absentee status. What kind of checks happen along the way, and how often are you finding folks who have moved or are no longer eligible to be voting absentee who get mailed the ballot automatically?
Madam Chair and members, there are about 8,100 people who currently have either ongoing or permanent absentee ballot status under the current law who are automatically mailed applications before every election. And one of the things that's done in this bill to improve the current process is it clarifies that if a voter becomes challenged or inactive for any reason, that they would no longer be sent a ballot. Current law specifies a few reasons, but doesn't say broadly if you become challenged or inactive. This bill also says that the ballots need to be sent by non-forwardable mail to ensure that people still live at the address and should be voting from that address. That is not in current law, so current law says that you would mail the application, and because it's not specified, it would be forwardable. So I think that there's actually protections in here that are not in place in current law that would strengthen the process. And at least right now, the permanent status or ongoing status is limited to people who have a reason, who have said, I am disabled, I am ill, I, you know, have an ongoing reason to reasonably believe I will not be able to go to the precinct. It includes people in the Safe at Home Address Confidentiality Program. And, you know, there are people for whom it's difficult to get to the polling place on an ongoing basis. And there are times, I think, especially when people first sign up for the status, where they expect, they think that they're signing up to receive a ballot. And so when the application comes, they either don't pay attention because they're waiting for their ballot, or they get an application and like, well, what's this? I've already applied. And then, unfortunately, very close to the election, they call and say, where's my ballot? And then the local official says, well, you need to, you know, send it in. And at this point, it may be too late for the transit time, especially for people in the Safe at Home Address Confidentiality Program who vote through a special process that has several extra steps.
Thanks, Ms. Frazier. Representative Sanders?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then, Mr. Chair, Ms. Frazier, can you walk me through kind of just kind of the next steps there? What is the current process or criteria for obtaining, under current law, permanent absentee status?
Madam Chair and Representative Sanders, currently a voter can apply for permanent or ongoing status if they meet any of the current reasons and expect to have that current reason apply on an ongoing basis to apply to all upcoming elections. So the current reasons are related to illness or disability or being outside of the precinct or being a participant in Safe at Home. Those are the primary reasons that somebody would qualify for this. So they would submit that application and it would be put on file, and then prior to each election, the election official would mail this person an application. They would send out all the applications at the same time. It's easier to do kind of a big mailing at once, and then as the applications trickle back in, they, you know, put together the materials and send out the ballot to the voter. And then it is returned and processed as any other absentee ballot is. One of the things that local election officials like about this proposal is that it would allow them to, instead of preparing applications to be sent all at once and then fulfilling the ballot requests as they come in, it would allow them at one time to fulfill all the ballot requests and to just send out the ballots, get them to voters as soon as possible, and give voters as much time to return them and not have to process the applications one by one as they're returned.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Frazier, so if I heard you correctly, there really isn't a permanent absentee status right now because you still have to apply. I mean, are we currently right now mailing out a ballot to folks without any sort of renewed application right now, whether you're in the Safe Home Confidentiality Program or you've applied for this status? They still have to go through the application process. They are not being mailed just the ballot. Is that correct?
Ms. Frazier.
Madam Chair and Representative Sanders, that's correct, that neither the permanent nor the ongoing status in current law allows a ballot to be sent directly to these voters. Only an application is automatically sent. If somebody is in a mail ballot precinct and they're registered to vote, they're automatically sent a ballot without an application. But these statuses do not allow you to send a ballot directly.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Frazier, for that. You know, I guess my initial reaction to that is I'm certainly open to the discussion, Representative Simon, on including some of those groups in a permanent status, especially the Safe Home Confidentiality Program. Something like that makes sense, especially when we're talking about people's safety and those sorts of issues. So I'm certainly open to that discussion. I'm also open to, mailing out an application to kind of everyone else. And we're talking about expanding absentee balloting here. I think I'm okay with sending it out an application to everybody else, but I do have major concerns over sending out a ballot to every single person that may vote absentee in one election, maybe knowing that they're going to be out of the state for work this year, but they still enjoy the responsibility of going to, or the privilege of going to, a polling place and voting on election day, and then the responsibility be upon them to contact the Secretary of State or write a letter or something like that to opt out of that program if they so desire, instead of perhaps not sending out the application and requesting the absentee. So I certainly have grave concerns over a permanent ballot status for any individual that I guess ever votes by absentee ballot under this proposal, but I'm certainly open to certain instances as listed here where we know there's permanent disability or the Safe Home Confidentiality Program, but those are my concerns at this point.
Representative Simon.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm wondering, I think there may be people here who are here to testify either on that provision or generally, and they want to be heard at this point.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, your talk had mentioned about the current reasons for this, except in line 2.8 and 2.9, you have that reasonability crossed out in this bill. So there would be no reason, the way I see it, read it, anybody could sign up for permanent status.
Ms. Fraser.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, that's true in the current bill.
Any questions? With that, I think we can, I know we've got two folks who have signed up to testify on this bill from the public. Thanks, Ms. Fraser. And so I will first call up Dan McGrath from Minnesota Majority. Welcome to the committee. Would you please state your name for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan McGrath. I'm the president of Minnesota Majority. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about some of the concerns that I have with the two bills that are up for discussion today. House File 193, and this comes back to kind of the eternal tug of war, I think, in dealing with election issues. It's the argument about access versus integrity. And there's usually one camp says we got to work on more access, and the other camp says we've got to work on more integrity. I don't understand why we can't do both. Minnesota has a great tradition of extraordinary voter turnout. We lead the nation all the time. Our Secretary of State likes to boast about that all the time. Our previous Secretary of State liked to boast about that. We're at the top in voter turnout. So rushing a couple of bills forth that are about access right now seems to be kind of the wrong timing. When we're already leading the nation in turnout, it looks like access isn't really the problem. But we do have some problems with integrity when at the same time that we're leading the nation in turnout, we're also leading the nation in convictions for voter fraud. So the two bills that are being discussed today, I don't think that they're the end of the world for our election system or anything like that, but I think that they can be improved upon if we have to go in that access direction by adding some integrity to the process. I find no excuse absentee voting preferable to the other proposal that it would supplant, which is early voting, for a few reasons. One, you can retract your ballot. Two, there's ballot boards that review the ballots as they come in that have citizen oversight. Early voting would eliminate citizen oversight. There's partisan poll challengers and volunteer type, paid volunteer election judges, just regular citizen election judges, would be taken out of that early voting process, which I find concerning. The other thing, with absentee voting and mail-in voting, all citizens, of course, have the right to vote, but we don't necessarily have the right to vote on our own terms, as in with absentee ballots. So I find it reasonable to require some additional documentation from people that want to take advantage of the convenience of absentee voting. Absentee voting was established as a convenience for people who may otherwise be unable to make it to the polls on election day, and that could be because of illness or disability or for being out of the country. Now, of course, the federal law mandates that we make absentee ballots available to military and overseas voters in the MOVE Act, but those are people that we know can't reasonably be expected to be in their local polling place on election day. Any voting by mail will, by its very nature, be more vulnerable to fraud and make it more difficult, if not impossible, to prosecute the perpetrators when fraudulent ballots are detected. A person attempting to vote multiple times under several fictitious identities would put themselves at greater risk by doing it in person. In-person voting is, I would say, the gold standard for how we should conduct our elections, and we should be very careful about expanding any process that goes outside of that norm. I think that should be obvious, that in-person voting is going to be more secure. So that's why I'm also skeptical of expanding mail-in voting, as House File 224 sets out to do. Glad to see it's been laid over for further discussion. Again, it's not an apocalyptic bill, but it's an incremental bill. Both of these bills that are being discussed today are incrementally loosening up our election system a little bit more. And I would like to see some additional safeguards put into those bills, or have those bills combined with some other integrity measures to give voters greater confidence in this. There's no reason that, even though we're the top of the game in voter turnout in Minnesota, that we can't still do better. I don't see any problem with trying to make it easier to vote, but we also at the same time have to consider how to make it harder to cheat. So thank you for allowing me this opportunity to testify, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McGrath, any specifics that you think we should include in these bills that would help with integrity?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, thank you for the question. The amendment that's been discussed a little bit today on adding or removing the checkbox essentially from absentee ballot applications and signature envelopes that says I don't have any ID or Social Security number, I think that's a good idea, but it doesn't have to be only used in a password sense. It can also be used for integrity purposes to verify that the person is who they say they are. As I said, absentee voting is not an absolute right, so I don't think it's onerous to ask persons voting absentee to provide some sort of verifiable identification number so we can say, yes, that is the person that they say they are. That would help prevent someone from obtaining someone else's absentee ballot and casting it fraudulently. If it's just a password, well, you can just make up any number and it's still going to go through. But if it's actually got to be a verifiable driver's license number or Social Security number or something like that, people won't be able to cast a ballot that doesn't belong to them.
Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, Mr. McGrath, anything else?
Well, I would like to see a little bit more robust, and this is a kind of a topic for a separate bill, perhaps, but in general, perhaps both of these bills should be laid over and included in some sort of an omnibus bill, where we can include some greater voter verification systems as part of a package deal. I would be more comfortable with these kind of proposals if they came along with some other integrity measures, like, you know, electronic poll books with photos or some kind of photo ID requirement or other identity and eligibility verification checks.
Thank you.
Additional questions for this testifier? No? Seeing none. Thank you very much, Mr. McGrath.
Thank you.
Next, we have a member of the public, Don Dickerson, would like to speak on this bill. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Don Dickerson of Roseville. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of this committee. I would like to speak on behalf of HF 193. The check mechanism for this piece of legislation is lacking and flawed. HF 193 is ripe with great potential for fraud. My two points are eligibility. How will the Secretary of State or county auditors handle the eligibility follow-up, ensuring current validity of each automatic absentee ballot recipient? This could potentially be needed for 2 to 4 times in any given year. A primary, a general election, and potentially a third and fourth time, given that there is a special election needed to fulfill a federal, state, county, city, or school board vacancy. Do we have the resources for this potential? Finally, access and transparency. Will there be transparency, ensuring fair and honest elections? We need election integrity for public confidence. This bill will move our state backwards and is ripe for fraud, not to mention potential partisanship. I urge a no vote by this committee. Thank you for your time.
Does anyone have any questions for this testifier? Seeing none, thank you for your time. Representative Simon, do you have additional?
Madam Chair, I don't, other than to say I think this is a work in progress. I think members here who have voiced concerns, it would be my preference that we lay this bill over as well, so as to give them some more time to think about their specific concerns in light of the testimony. And I'm hopeful that at some point we can reach an accommodation where we can move on these bills one way or another, but probably not today.
Thank you. I didn't ask if there were other members of the public that wished to testify on this bill. I'm sorry. It looks like there is another person who'd like to speak to this.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mark Hughes from Shoreview. I just have a quick comment.
Mr. Hughes?
I disagree with Mr. McGrath. While we try to do the top things in the state as far as voting, it seemed to me I had a prior discussion with Secretary of State Mark Ritchie, who said we need to do something about more about getting out the voters. We were about a million voters short this last election as far as turnout, and I would disagree on foregoing the absentee ballot. One thing is, I'm a businessman and I travel some, and if I were to miss an election, I would still have an option to absentee ballot, and I also have a family member sick at home with Alzheimer's. To bring her out in public would be kind of tough to stand her in line and have her wait, and so we've done the absentee ballot deal at home, and it works out just fine. So I hope you'll take some of that into consideration. With that, I say thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there other comments or questions from committee members today? House File 193. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Frazier could come up one more time. Sorry.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Frazier.
I'm just helping with your exercise program, apparently. You had mentioned earlier, and again, I had a chance to ponder this, you had said about the application for an absentee ballot application going out in the mail, and then people were calling the local officials and saying, where is my ballot? It's getting close to election day. How long does it typically take from any data on turnaround from ballots from the time that they're sent out from a local or back to the auditor's office in that county? And I'll tell you right where I'm going with the same thing I had asked last time with the Postal Service looking to reduce service. Does that provide any concerns to the Secretary of State's office in the ability to be able to process absentee ballots?
Ms. Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll. I don't have any data about turnaround time for domestic absentees. We were just doing a report yesterday on military and overseas absentee ballots, and the turnaround time, I think, on average was between 13 and 15 days. Now, military and overseas voters have the option to receive their ballots electronically, so it cuts down the transit time. So I don't know what the turnaround time is for domestic voters on average. I do think that there are concerns about eliminating Saturday delivery and how that will slow down mail delivery, and it's going to be more important to emphasize to voters that they need to return their ballots as soon as possible to ensure that they arrive by Election Day.
Representative O'Driscoll.
It's everyone on this committee's wishes and intentions to preserve the integrity of the process and to not disenfranchise people. And since we have the federal government who's involved in the mail system, we have to be dealing with their reduction of service and some of the other things that they're dealing to us. And since we're talking about absentee and mail balloting, I think that's an important thing that we have to take a look at, since we're going to be reducing by 1/6 the number of days that mail service is going to be offered during the week. I'm not saying it's insurmountable. I'm thinking we have to make sure that we're thinking ahead of the curve on this, because I don't want to have this committee being back here in 2 years saying, gosh, we had 10,000 people who cast a ballot and sat in the mailbox on Saturday and went back the next Monday and was still sitting there and they didn't get a chance to vote or they getting their vote counted. That would be one of the worst things that we could do, knowing today, this early on in the process, that that's a challenge that we're going to have to be dealing with. Don't have the answers, just wanting to make sure that we keep it on the to-do list or the consideration list.
Madam Chair and
Ms.
Representative O'Driscoll, to that point, I mean, actually increasing the use of mail balloting and sending ballots directly to people who are on the permanent list will actually give them more of a chance to vote because it means that ballots will be mailed to them 46 days before the election. And instead of having the application mailed to them and having them have to return the application and then mailing the ballot to them and having them have to return the filled out ballot. So it actually should increase their success.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Which, not trying to cross bills that this committee is considering, but that does bring up the question of the, and I'll just reference the technical graphic that the chair put together for us that talked about the timeline of summer summer vacancy and some of those kinds of things with the ballots, mail ballots having to go out and which ballot do I need to have and which is if we have to have a replacement candidate and things on there. I think we just need to think about it in its more global consequences or unintended consequences, I should say. And again, I think everybody around this committee wants to move it in the right direction, but those are things that are unintended consequences that we could be bumping up against.
Representative Simon, do you wish to respond?
Madam Chair, I have none for now. I think if there are no other comments, it's probably just best to lay the bill over again.
Very good. Are there any additional comments on this bill today? With that, we can lay the bill over, and I will turn the chair back over to the chair.
Just take the gavel so we're adjourned. Well, I don't know if it's that good.
Members, just a preview here of what's to come. We have determined, some of you may know that 2 days ago the Campaign Finance Board came out with a pretty sweeping list of recommendations on the issue of disclosure. Not campaign finance, but the disclosure part of their portfolio, meaning what all of us, the forms that all of us and all public officials have to fill out and what the public is entitled to know about our financial arrangements and holdings and assets and all of that for purposes of determining whether there are conflicts of interest. So we've invited Gary Goldsmith from the Campaign Finance Board to give an overview of that next Tuesday. And I just want to say, members, unlike other types of overviews, this isn't your normal overview. This is full of actual, very specific legislative recommendations. And I think one of the chunks of activity that we're going to be involved with, I guess you could say, is the disclosure law piece. And I expect that this session will be either adopting or choosing not to adopt some of their recommendations and taking up some other disclosure-related recommendations that some members of this committee and others might have. So it's not just sort of generalities. I think he'll be talking about very specific recommendations, which we're free, not on Tuesday, obviously, but we're free to either adopt or not adopt or adopt in part. So I think it'll be important to get a flavor of what's to come, and I expect that this year we'll be taking up that issue of disclosure. So that'll be coming up on Tuesday. Any final thoughts or comments from members? Okay. If not, the meeting's adjourned.